The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Wow. This is so great. Thank you so much for coming. It is so good to be home. I'm thrilled to be here. So I'm on a book tour. The book came out yesterday, and I'm gone for 2 weeks. And my husband took that occasion of me sort of saying, okay, you know, gone for 2 weeks, 12 cities, you know, to remind me of the sanctity of our marital vows. And he said, now, no cheating on the road. And I said, what? Like, is this the tour where dudes start reading my books? Really? There's one. Because it would be so great, you know, because my Nana calls me the day I have a book comes out. She calls and says, well, new? How'd the reading go? And she called last night. She said, how'd the reading go? I said, Nana, it was a sausage fest. She says, what? I said, wall-to-wall cock. And where's my husband? Adam, are you still here and do you still love me? Where is he? Seriously, wait. Oh, there you are. Hi. Okay, everybody turns. Like, who's the poor jerk married her, right? Is your mom's not here, right? Because she's mad at me again. We had a party a couple weeks ago, and I had this like, I don't know if it was eczema or allergies or what, but I had these like red rash on my neck. And so my mother-in-law, in her singular and unique style, you know, I'm in a room full of strangers, like trying to do the cocktail party small talk, I'm a normal person thing, and she walks up and says, "What's that on your neck?" And if I'd been just a little quicker, I would have looked at her and said, what's that on yours? And she would have said, my head. And I would have said, you keep telling yourself that, sister. Huh? But she says, what's that red stuff on your neck? And I'm like, rough sex. That whole David Carradine thing, it just was very inspirational to your son. You know, but don't worry, we have a safe word. It's cock, which is really confusing because it's like cock, cock. I gave a speech at my synagogue a couple of weeks ago. I think they had to dip the whole building in the mikvah. My poor rabbi, it's like he and my mother-in-law are like just sitting together. Like, the hell's wrong with her? She talks to God with that mouth. But I'm so thrilled to be here. Like I said, I was in New York last night, and my best friend, Susan, came to the reading, which is great because I got to bust on her. Because when you're a writer, you get a lot of questions, and you get these sort of, where do your ideas come from? And I say Target. And then I got my all-time favorite question, which is, Jennifer Weiner really your name? What? I'm like, if I was going to make something up, you don't think I could have done, like, better than this? Really? But one of the questions that I get a lot is, why do you hate Canada? And I don't hate Canada, even though there's, like, shots at Canada that have been taken in most of my books. Susan hates Canada because she dated a guy named Ian from Montreal, and it ended so badly that she now hates the entire nation. Violently. And this hatred would manifest itself in weird ways. Like, she would see Peter Jennings when he was still alive. She would see him on the news and she'd be like, you know, he's not even an American citizen. He's taking some American's job. And Susan and I, like, after Ian from Montreal, after that whole, like, debacle, she and I were, like, single girls for that decade when you're single girls, and she was going on lots of dates, and she would call me from the bathroom of her dates to, like, let me know how things were going. It was before texting. This is what you had to resort to, was, like, actually speaking to somebody on the phone. It was rough. It was uphill both ways to school. But, you know, she would call me and she would say something like, "He's wearing a toupee that looks like his kid made it out of pine needles at summer camp." And I'd say, "So you're not going to see him again?" She's like, "I didn't say that." "Maybe he'll take it off." You know, and then there was the man who asked for the bread basket to go. It was no good. Like, "You're not going to see that guy again." She's like, "Well, he's got jam now." But finally, Susan found true love, and she met a doctor, which for a Jewish girl, it's the Holy Grail. She met a doctor. And she was like, "This is it. Done deal." And he was on call a lot, as doctors tend to be. So what she did was she started moving her things into his house when he was gone. Every day I'd get the call, "Come help me pack the car." And we would load it with her dishes and her clothing and her dog. And she would move these things into his house. And this went on over 2 months, sort of the gradual accumulation of goods into this man's house. And finally, after about, you know, 2 months of this, she woke up one morning and looked at him and said, "I don't feel right about this." And he says, "You don't feel right about what?" And she's like, "Well, we're living together. And I don't feel right about it." And he says, "We're living together?" And she says, "Yes. And what kind of example are we setting for your daughters?" And he's like, "Well, I guess we have to get married." And she says, "Well, I guess we do." So the shit worked. I had to talk dirty a lot. She didn't have to do any of that. But the beauty of my friend Susan is, you know, we tell each other everything. We've been there for each other through the highs and the lows and the creamy middles and the bad J-dates. And, you know, this, you guys know J-date, right? J-date, as I call it sometimes. There was a Jewish dating website in my last book, and its motto was "For the unchosen, chosen people." That might have been my finest work right there. That might have been it. But Susan was the friend I called. You know, back in the day, I was on WeddingChannel.com, and I was buying somebody a wedding present, and I, you know, clicked and did my purchase. And then there was, you know, a blank where you could, you know, search for couples, and I happened to type in the name of every guy I'd ever dated. I know how that happened. You know, and sure enough, one of them came up with this girl that he was engaged to and going to marry. And it was sort of like, you know, I mean, I wanted no part of him anymore. Like, the relationship had been over. I wished him well, kind of, you know. It's like, I mean, this was the breakup where I really hoped the guy would get leprosy. I did. I, you know, was sort of actively wishing that his limbs would fall off and I would see him on a street corner someday with four stumps and a change cup, turning the pages of one of my best-selling books with his tongue. So, you know, but there's a lid for every pot, and somebody married his pot, and yes, he enjoyed that sort of thing. Cooking. So of course, like, I freaked. And I download the registry, everything they've signed up for, and I email it to Susan with, you know, urgent. It's flagged urgent, this email, with the red flag, you know, like the thing, you know, it's like code DEFCON 3, you know, like, "Call me now." And she calls me. And I'm like, "Oh my God, I can't believe it. He's getting married." It's like, he's marrying this woman. I can tell just from the registry. She's the opposite of me in every way. They registered for a food scale. "Oh, yes. Happy wedding wishes with your food scale." The hell was that about? You're like, what do you say on the card? You know, like, "Best wishes for a happy life together. Don't eat more than 4 ounces of chicken breast at once." This is very messed up. So Susan, you know, she's the friend who sort of, like, talks you off the ledge. She's like, "Look, they're registered for an acrylic chip and dip set." She's like, "You dodged a bullet, sister." You could be in New Jersey eating guac off acrylic. So, you know, that was a good feeling. But I actually used that story, the Googling the wedding registry, which I know I'm not the only one who did it. Y'all can look innocent, but, like, I know. That's why God invented the internet, right? To, like, check up on your exes, right? That's what it's there for. So I used this. I wrote a short story about a girl who, she's home with a 6-month-old. She's going out of her mind. Her husband's working, and she goes online and finds her ex-boyfriend, and he's registered. But she remembers his password. And so she logs on as him and starts, like, effing with his registry. And the first thing she does is sign the happy couple up for a Hitachi magic wand. For those of you who are not laughing, a Hitachi magic wand is a big old vibrator. Yes. Now, that would make a good wedding gift, I think. But, you know, so I write this story, and I'm, like, really amused by the whole concept of the Hitachi magic wand. And I email it off to my agent, who is the first person who reads my stuff. And my agent sends the story back with a little Post-it note that says, "What is a Hitachi magic wand?" And I'm like, well, look, she went to Catholic school, like, through graduate school, like, she still calls her down there, you know? You know? Every once in a while, I'm like, "Hey, Joanna, say cocksucker." And she's like, I can't. I'm like, "Do you want to keep me as a client?" She's like, I can't do it. I'm like, 15%. She's like, "Cocksucker!" You know, sometimes there's just nothing good on cable. To amuse myself somehow. So anyhow, so she sends the story back. What is a Hitachi magic wand? I'm like, I'm not even getting into this. Like, I'm not even explaining this to her. Like, let her Google it, you know, right? Because, you know, she would have asked her assistant. Like, I made this mistake. Like, my age is showing. Like, do you remember the whole, like, tea bag protests? The whole tea party. And everybody was like, tea bag. And so I go to my assistant, who's, like, hip and young. I'm like, "What's tea bagging?" And she gives me this, like, really strange look. So then I look it up on urbandictionary.com, and I'm like, oh, my God. And then I was, like, terrified she was going to quit because I was creating a hostile work environment. I'm really sorry. I just didn't mean to put that picture in your head or anything. But okay, so Joanna sends the story back, and I elect not to tell her what the Hitachi magic wand is. And so I send it to my editor in New York, right? And my editor is, like, cool and hip. She grew up in San Francisco. She's going to know what this is, right? And I get the story back, and there's the exact same note. What is a Hitachi magic wand? At which point I realize I'm a pervert. Which probably isn't news to any of you now. But anyhow, this is Best Friends Forever, which I stuck a name tag on, so that's me. This is Best Friends Forever. And I want a show of hands. Those of you who've seen the cover, who thinks this girl is picking her bathing suit out of her ass crack? Okay? Show of hands. Don't be shy. Come on. Yes. Thank you. Like, they send me the cover. They send me the cover, and they're like, yeah, right, yeah? It's true, isn't it? They send me the cover, and they're like, "What do you think?" And I'm like, "I think she's picking a wedgie." Additionally, I think it looks like a douchad. Right? Best friend. Do you ever have that not-so-fresh feeling? And they're like, "Well, we really like it." And I'm like, "It looks like a douche ad." And they're like, "Barnes & Noble really likes it." I'm like, "I like it too." That's good stuff right there. Mm. I mean, I guess it is, like, you know, if I'm all about sort of realistic depictions of women, I guess that is a realistic depiction of, like, what you do on the beach. Tugless tank my ass. Land's End. But I love the chart, you know, like the triangle if you want to cover, like, your hip area, and, like, the roundy if you want to cover your, like, middle, and then the star if it's all fucked up. They just send you a burqa. It's like, that's not going to make me feel any better about myself, Land's End. I'm not feeling good with this slim suit. Who are you kidding? Anyhow, shouldn't have drunk lunch probably, but Siobhan is back there somewhere rethinking my appointment to the board. But I'm going to read a little bit of Best Friends Forever, and then I will take your questions, because that's always the happiest part of my night. Just please don't ask me if my name is really Jennifer Weiner. It's like, it's guilty. Basically, Best Friends Forever, it's the story of these two women. There's Addie and there's Val, and they're best friends all through elementary school, all through junior high, and then they get into high school. Val goes away for the summer and comes back, and she's like grown 3 inches, and her hair is straight, and she has boobies. So, you know, things start going wrong in their friendship, and Val becomes a cheerleader, and there's a big falling out over a boy that I will not go into. And then we flash forward 15 years later, and Addie, who's sort of the, like, ugly duckling mousy friend, is stuck in this small town in the Midwest. And it's the night of the reunion, which, of course, Addie hasn't gone to. And there's a knock on the door, and she opens it, and there is Val, like, pale as a ghost. And there's blood on her sleeve, and she says, "Something terrible's happened, and you're the only one who can help." And for a while, I would tell the story, and I'd be like, you know, I just have to figure out that something terrible. Like, either she killed someone or got her period unexpectedly. I don't know, but... So, long story short, Val's done something bad, and she and Addie are on the run, Thelma and Louise style, when we meet them. "Addie, where are we?" My tongue felt thick. I blinked, wriggling around in my seat. "About 100 miles outside of Chicago. We need money," Val said. I tried to remember what I'd had in my purse when she'd shown up. "I've got $50, I told her. She shook her head. "That's not enough. But don't worry, I have a plan." She nodded toward the entrance of the restaurant. A mother with a baby in her arms and a little curly-headed girl at her side walked through the doors. I looked at Val. "Oh, no. Come on. You want to rob a McDonald's?" "Maybe a liquor store," she said a little defensively, "or a 7-Eleven. Don't you always read about places like that getting robbed? I bet it's easy." I didn't answer, thinking that I was always reading about the arrests of people who tried to rob fast food restaurants and liquor stores, which meant it probably wasn't easy at all. "We could just go to a bank," I said. "Of course," she said, "because that's where the money is. Okay, here's what I'm thinking. We buy masks at a drugstore. I'll do the talking. We'll tell them we want $10,000 in unmarked bills." "Here's what I'm thinking," I said. "It's a month after Halloween. No place is going to have masks, so we just find a TD Bank where I have checking and savings accounts, and I'll make a withdrawal." "You can't do that," she said. "They'll find out. They'll trace it. They'll know we were here." Ugh, like they're not going to catch us if we rob a bank in Halloween masks. I took a swig of warm water from the bottle in my purse. "Listen, have you thought about what happens when this is over?" She crossed her arms over her chest, looking sullen. "Dan will either turn up or he won't. Dan's the guy." "And then what? What about your job?" "No, they're not expecting me back till Tuesday, and it's not a big deal if I take a few days off," she said. "They probably just think I went and had a boob job or something." "You don't need to tell them that in advance." She shook her head in sorrow at the extent of my naivete. "Addie, if you tell them in advance, then it leaks. Then all the bloggers publish before and after pictures, and everybody knows." "But if you get a boob job, isn't everyone going to know anyhow? Isn't people noticing kind of the point?" She rolled her eyes. "You just say you got some sun." "Fantastic. Look, just drop me off at a bank, and I'll get us all the money we need." Of course, it wasn't as easy as that. The bank was packed and overheated, and I had to wait by the automated change counter for a spot at the back of the line. "I'd like to make a withdrawal, please," I said when the teller finally beckoned me forward, and I slid my slip and driver's license across the counter. An instant later, Valerie, with a fringed scarf wrapped burqa-style over her head and most of her face, sidled up beside me and snatched the slip back. "This is a robbery," she told the teller. "Oh, for God's sake, Val, it's not. It's not," I said to the teller. She had a round face and red lipstick and a felt and fake fur Santa hat. She looked from my face to Val's and back again. "I've got a gun," Val whispered. "Give me what's in the drawer." She pulled a plastic shopping bag out of her purse and held it open in front of the teller's startled face. "Put it in here. Nobody moves. Nobody gets hurt. Come with me if you want to live." And then, apparently having run out of movie lines to quote, she waved the empty bag for emphasis. "Ignore her," I said to the teller, whose name tag read Tiara. I tried to give her my license and the slip again. Val clamped her hand down over mine. We need 10 G's in unmarked, non-sequential bills, she said through lips that barely moved. No dye packets, no alarms. Be cool, sister, and we'll make it out of here just fine. Tiara finally opened her mouth, revealing a wad of grape-scented gum the size of a golf ball. Oh, my God. Ignore her, I repeated. She does not have a gun. Do so. Val reached into her purse and pulled out a slim rectangle of what looked like sterling silver. Now, you get busy living or get busy dying. Valerie, I said, that is a tampon case. Yeah, well, I've got a gun. It's in here somewhere. Val unloaded mints and makeup and leather luggage tags onto the narrow ledge of the counter. Meanwhile, Tiara had unlocked her drawer and was sliding banded stacks of money at me. I was pushing them back at her as Val pulled something else out of her handbag. Here, that's an eyelash curler. This? iPod. Listen, Tiara whispered to us, just leave two stacks of 50s in the green Saturn parked in the corner out back and we're good. I won't pull the alarm till you leave. Val's eyes lit up. Seriously? She asked. You are so cool. Jesus, I said. Listen, Tiara, we aren't doing this. We're not. Here you go. Tiara had gone pale, but her hands were working smoothly. Packets of bills tumbled into the bag. I looked around to see if anyone in the bustling bank was noticing the robbery in progress, but it didn't look that way. At the station next to me, a small bald man was arguing with the teller about when his out-of-state check would clear, and there was a commotion over by the change counter that seemed to have resulted from somebody's purse-sized dog pooping on the floor. That's 10,000, said Tiara. You're going to take care of me, right? We got you, Val promised, and looped the bag's handles around one wrist. Thanks. I waited until Val was out the door, then took my slip back, crossed out the $2,000 I'd planned on taking out, and wrote in 10. Just take it out of my savings, okay? I said to Tiara, who nodded, continuing to work at her gum, as placid as if she got robbed every day of the week. As long as you take care of me, she said, and I nodded. What choice did I have? Merry Christmas, she called, and I wished her the same. So that is Best Friends Forever. And now, if anybody wants to ask me anything, books, movies, Philadelphia, mother-in-law, yes.
So in Certain Girls,
uh-huh.
Joy grows up and discovers what she thinks is her mom's story.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what you think about what might happen when your girls grow up.
Uh-huh. Yes, yes. Well, in Certain Girls, as she said, it's the story of this 13-year-old girl who discovers that her mother has written a scandalous book. So when I wrote my first book, Good in Bed, I didn't have kids, and I wasn't thinking of kids or what would happen if I had them, and someday they were just like, holy hell, what's this? So I think that Certain Girls, in a lot of ways, was my attempt to sort of like get my head around the idea that like all children confront their parents' past at some point, I think. But maybe not. Like, I've always been very comforted. Erica Jong, who wrote Fear of Flying, which was, like, a genuinely, like, sexy and disturbing book, has a daughter. And she said, you know, when her daughter was a teenager, she picked up Fear of Flying and read, like, 10 pages and put it down and said, you know, I don't really want to read this. And I have great hopes that it's going to, like, work out that way. Because I really should have titled, you know, instead of calling it Good in Bed, I should have called it, like, Don't Read This Book, Lucy, which... It wouldn't have done as well in bookstores, probably. Like, you know, but it's so funny with that title because they say that as an author, like, the happiest day you will ever have is when you get to go home and tell your mom that someone is publishing your book. And that is not the case if it's called Good in Bed. I mean, I remember, you know, when I got the word that this was going to happen, I went to Connecticut and I'm like, you know, that novel, I said to my mom, that novel you never believed I was writing, someone is going to publish it. And, you know, they paid me. And she gets all teary and she's so thrilled and she gives me a hug and she says, I'm so proud. And then she says, what's it called? And I'm like, oh no. And I say, Good in Bed. And she says, Good and Bad. And I say, no. And she says, Good in Bed? And I said, mm-hmm. And she says, how much research did you do? And I'm like, my safe word's cock. And then I left. And, you know, always leave them wondering. Yeah. But, you know, it's, so I don't know. know what my daughters are going to, like, make of all of this, but I'm hoping that, like, you know, teenagers are pretty, like, solipsistic and self-involved, so maybe they just won't care, you know? It'll be like, she writes books. And, like, at that point, books might be pills that you swallow. So, like, the idea that I wrote something that was printed on paper and available in stores, it's like, what, did you ride a dinosaur to school, too? I'm hoping that technology is going to solve all my problems, like, basically. You know, I'm waiting for the hovercraft and the book and pill form and that whole thing. So we have microphones, right? So raise your hand and then somebody, yes, right here. Okay, you got to wait for the microphone. Yes, but here it is, see? It's a fast-moving microphone. Okay. Go. Okay.
I love the book, In Her Shoes.
Thank you.
And I'm just wondering at the end when Maggie reads the poem, the E.E. Cumming poems to mm-hmm. Rose.
Yes.
It's very appropriate for the relationship that the two of them had, but I'm wondering, was E.E. Cummings' original intent of a male to a woman, was it a romantic poem? And how did you pick that?
I Carry Your Heart is the E.E. Cummings poem, and I don't know. But you have to understand, like, I went to college in the late 80s, early 90s, where we deconstructed everything and divorced text from authorial intent. So, like, he could have written it to, like, his dog, like, and I still would have appropriated the text. Yes. Didn't I really sound smart just then? Where's my husband? Did you hear that? Was that good? Yeah? He doesn't care. He's so over me. Divorce the text from the authorial intent. That's my new safe word. Who else wants to know something? Right there.
I've heard you speak once before, and
I
around
was
the
dirty, wasn't I? I don't know what's going on. I might have fallen.
Well, you were at Borders, and you were talking about, you know, In Her Shoes again, and you were talking about how some of what you live in life and your family and friends, they show up in your writing. Mm-hmm. How do your friends and family actually feel when they recognize parts of their lives in your stories?
Well, this is the truth of it. Like, stuff that happens to me rarely makes it into fiction sort of untransformed. Stuff that happens to me, I'll use it, but I'll turn it, I'll make it more funny or more poignant or more meaningful or more sad. You can't, I mean, life is raw material. And what I've learned over the years and over the books is that even if something happened to you, and even if you felt it very deeply, and even if it hurt you very much, like, it doesn't necessarily mean anybody is going to care as a reader. Like, you know, your therapist might, but, you know, you have to sort of spin the straw of life into the gold of fiction. That being said, I do let friends and family read early drafts of stuff because sometimes I don't even know what I'm doing. You know, it's like something will happen and I'll just, like, use it and I'll forget where I heard it or forget that, you know, somebody said, like, please don't put this in a book, which, like, you know, did you ever see that Far Side cartoon where the guy's talking to his dog and he's like, now, Ginger, don't jump on the table, Ginger, and don't run outside, Ginger, and all the dog is hearing in the next panel is blah, blah, Ginger, blah, blah, Ginger. Like, I think that's me with, like, and don't put this in a book. And I hear blah, blah, book. I write books. Like, that's... So, I do let people read ahead of time, and I'm lucky that, like, my friends and family members all have, like, really good senses of humor and are pretty easygoing about things, and, you know, and then there's sort of the Anne Lamott rule of, like, writing about guys, which is, like, you change the name because guys are sometimes not really, like, if a guy is Steve and in the book the guy is Stu, the guy doesn't really necessarily, like, not that men are stupid, but for some reason that works. I don't know why. She's like, you know, change the name, change the job, because men tend to, like, identify very closely with what they do. So if he's an accountant and you make him a forensic accountant, he's like, oh, that's not me. And then you have to give them a little tiny penis. And this, again, this is Anne Lamott, okay, not me. But she's just like, you know, if you give them a teeny tiny penis, no man will ever tell anybody. I make them premature ejaculators, too, like to just really forestall the possibility of ever winding up in court. But I will also tell you another thing I've learned is that bad people don't see themselves in books. because they don't want to believe they're bad people. So, like, if somebody, like, you know, treats you badly or does something nasty or is mean to your kid or whatever, and you use that in a book, rarely will they see that as themselves. But if they do, this is what you do, okay? Like, if, for example, somebody reads a character in a book who is, like, mean and superficial and label-obsessed and grasping and says to someone in your life, "Is that me?" What you say to that person, looking at them very calmly, is, "Why would you think that?"
Works every time.
Yeah, there's kids here. Now I'm feeling bad. I'm really sorry. That's okay. Therapy. She doesn't speak English. Okay. We're doing earmuffs. 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 Who else would like to know? I feel like I'm neglecting the side of the room. Yes. In the middle, right here. And then I'm going to put my glasses on so I can see the rest of you. Isn't that nice of me? Yes. I was in L.A. last week, and I tell a story while we're getting the mic. My brother Joe is dating this new girl, and it turns out in the course of my interrogation of this new girl that she was married beforehand, and she's 30. So I'm like, well, this is an interesting story, like the brief youthful marriage. And I'm like, well, what happened? And she's like, oh, I don't really want to talk about it, which I, of course, take as a cue to keep asking her. So I'm like, no, really, really, what happened? And she finally, like, she spits it out. She says, "I found out my husband was gay." And I'm like, oh, snap. Like, how did you find that out? Like, did he come out to you? And she's like, no, he didn't come out to me. He isn't really out yet. He's Mormon. And it's like the whole, like, there's a lot of stigma attached. I'm like, he's a gay Mormon. He's a Gorman. And she's like, no, he's not a Gorman. He's not out of the closet. And I'm like, well, if he didn't come out to you, like, how did you find out about all this? Like, you know, like the history of the computer was, you know, and she's like, no, I walked in on him doing something gay. And I'm like, what? Right? I'm like, was he singing along to Right Said Fred? And she says, I don't really want to talk about this, but at this point, like, my sister and my sister-in-law and I are, like, triple-teaming this poor girl. And we're like, what did he do? What was something gay? What was it? What wasn't? And she's finally like, okay, you guys, he was watching soccer. And I'm like, watching soccer? That's not gay. It's lame, but it's not gay. And she's like, well, he was doing something else while he was watching soccer. And we're like, yeah, that's bad, probably. But then I thought about it for a minute, and I'm like, okay, like, I know guys. Like, could it have been that he was just, like, multitasking? You know, like, soccer's slow. It's a low-scoring game, you know? So, like, maybe he was, like, you know, he's watching the game, and there was this other thing he meant to take care of. And they were just two activities that happened to coincide. And she's like, no, he's gay. And he's gay, and she's now a former Mormon. A foreman. So, anyhow, she's a lovely girl. I don't think she's speaking to me now either, but that's okay. Somebody in the middle had a, yes.
Yeah, I had a question. How is your writing going in your, you know, I followed your blog where you're writing in your closet, basically. I mean, is that going okay, or do you still wish there's a coffee shop that's going to open up?
Well, they closed the Cozy at 2nd and Lombard, right? That was where I used to go, and they closed it. Now Stephen Starr is going to turn it into a pizza place, which is awesome, except I don't think he's going to appreciate me working there every day. Yeah, it was, I loved that. I worked there for years. And, one time, like right after my first daughter was born and I was just starting to work outside the house again, I ran out of the house with like my laptop and my wallet and like my spit up stained shirt and my hair's all messy. And I'm sitting there and I'm working and I go to get my latte and I order my latte and I go to pay for my latte. And they're like, oh no, don't worry. It's on the house. And I was so excited. I called my husband. I'm like, oh my God, like they give me free coffee. I think they know I'm a writer. And he's like, they could just think you're homeless. But yeah, the writing in the closet's not going so good because the little baby learned how to open doors It was really great before she could walk, but now she walks and she's like got this drunken sailor thing going on. She like stumbles around and I do this like monologue for her, which is like, I'm drunk. I'm going to text him. You know? Cause like, she's little. She's really little and she doesn't know any jokes. And so it amuses me. Like, she walked into a screen door a couple of weeks ago. And my mom is like, oh, Phoebe. And I'm still doing the drunk baby voice. And I'm like, what the fuck was that? What happened? I'm going to text him. My husband is going to divorce me. You know I do this, right? Like the drunk baby. He's like, I don't know nothing about the drunk baby, ex-wife. But yeah, so I the writing in the closet is not going very well. And there's Cafe Fulia at 2nd and it's on South 2nd Street, but like they have really good baklava, so that's a problem too. So I'm like looking for my new home. I'm like writer without a home. I wander the streets of Queen Village with my laptop. It's very sad. Yeah, so like sometimes I'm at the Starbucks and sometimes I'm at the Turkish place and, where else do I go? Like I can't be somewhere where there's another writer because then I get jealous, you know, it's like bad energy. So I don't know. I gotta find another place. Maybe I could work something out with Steven Starr. They could like put a little sign on my table, like writer at work. I could have a tip cup, you know, like that'd be good. Yes, on the aisle here.
Hi. You're very funny. And that made me think of the question, you know, have you ever considered being a comedian? And if no,
well, I need to bring my daughter with me and she'd need to stagger around.
You're funnier than most comedians I've seen.
Oh, thank you.
But
well, I'm really shy in person, so like that would so not.
So, I guess my other question is if you hadn't been a writer, what would you have done?
I would have gone to law school, like everybody else, you know, like it's just, I don't know what I want to do. I got to make some money. That looks good. Probably, law school maybe, or like, I would have maybe tried to get a PhD in something. I don't know. I would have lived off my husband. Yes. Leech. Well, because I'd been a newspaper reporter before, but clearly that wasn't going to work out long term. You know, it's like, ugh, all my friends got laid off. It's very sad. So I don't know, though. I think a lot of, like, bright people who can write well go into law school, and then they try to sneak jokes into their briefs, and it doesn't work out so good. But, maybe I'll do stand-up someday. But except, did you see that show Last Comic Standing? Where it was like 20 comics competing to like get a show and half of them had already had shows. And I'm like, these aren't good odds. Like, you know, if you've already had a sitcom and you like are now appearing on a reality show to try to like get your break and no good. No good. Anybody else? Anybody over here? Nobody over here has asked. In front, right here. Who do I like to read? I love Susan Isaacs. She's one of my favorites because she writes these great, smart, funny female characters who are like sexy and sharp and they're not always like tiny little babes. I like her a lot. I read this great book called Admission this spring, which was written from, it was a woman who was a reader in the Princeton admissions office. And she wrote this novel about an admissions officer who's like going around the Northeast sort of cherry picking kids to admit and grappling with her own dark secrets. I read the book like 90%, like just totally riveted as, you know, a reader. And then 10% is, well, like 8% is thinking, how did I ever get into Princeton? Like I would never get in today. Like I'm dumb as a box of rocks compared to these people. And then 2% of me is thinking, how are my kids going to ever get in here? Like, what do I have to do? Because there was one where she's talking about this one kid who applies and the development office has flagged the application because the parents are alumni and big donors. And I wanted to like email the author and be like, okay, so how much did they give? Like what's enough here? Because I sort of suspect that my literary achievements might not be that impressive to Princeton. I don't know. when Good in Bed came out, I sent it to all of my professors. I sent it to Joyce Carol Oates and Toni Morrison and John McPhee. And I imagine all of them sort of standing around, like looking at the book, being like, Good in Bed? Nah, I don't remember her at all. Nope. But, yeah, so admissions was great. I read a book called The Help this spring by Catherine Stockett, which was fantastic. It was about black maids and this sort of crusading but conflicted white woman in Jackson, Mississippi, sort of at the dawn of the civil rights movement. It was really, really, really terrific. So, yeah, you know, and I usually talk about what I'm reading on my web blog, which is jenniferweiner.blogspot.com, because I am fabulously creative. Or you can friend me on Facebook, and I talk about it there, too. So, yes. Yes. Right there. I'm sorry.
Okay. I'm interested in hearing how you started writing. How did you get started?
How did I get started writing? Well, I always was a reader, and that was sort of the first thing. I grew up in a house full of books. I loved reading. My parents loved reading. They read to me. They read. There's four kids in my family, and they read to all of us. And I think as soon as I learned how to write, I loved doing it. I loved the idea of telling stories. And the idea that you could make a living doing this was completely enchanting to me. So I read everything I could get my hands on as a teenager. I was an English major in college, so I got to read all the good stuff. I graduated in 1991. There was a recession, and I went to my parents. I knew I wanted to be a writer, and so I said to them, like, would either of you would like to be a patron of the arts? And support me while I write my novel about how your divorce hurt me. And they both said no. So I got a job at a newspaper at the Center Daily Times in State College, Pennsylvania. And I, yes, Happy Valley. Uh-huh, right, yes. And I worked there. I covered school districts. I wrote about education. So I was like, you know, I covered teacher strikes and, you know, class trips. I typed in the school lunches every week. I did, really. You know, every day, every Friday, I'd be like, you know, hot dog, bun, tater tots, fruit cup milk. I did not go to Princeton to do this. But it was really good training. It was. It made me humble. And, you know, so I was a journalist for 10 years, and that, I think, helped a lot with writing in terms of crafting stories, in terms of writing leads that would get people to want to keep reading, in terms of pacing and dialogue and, you know, observation of sort of how people are in the world and how they talk, how they dress, how they move, all that stuff. So, you know, reader, English major, journalist. I think that's, you know, that's what's worked for me. But different people do it different ways. You know, like, there is no one right answer, because I honestly think that if you're born to be a writer, you're going to do it no matter what. Like, whether you go to school for it or not, whether you get a master's in it or not, whether you know, have a fancy desk or not, like, you're just going to write, because there's no stopping it. Yes. Yes. My favorite book as a kid, like little kid or medium kid or fat kid, like what are we? gosh. I really liked Anne of Green Gables. I loved, you know, because Anne was like this plucky orphan who talked too much, and I could identify with, you know, not the orphan part, although, like, every kid has that fantasy of, like, you're not my real parents, my real parents are cool. But, you know, that she was sort of like this not very attractive, but very smart and very, like, mouthy kid who has these great adventures. So Anne of Green Gables actually shows up in Best Friends Forever, where Addie is reading it when Val shows up, and she thinks, will this be the Diana to my Anne, you know, my bosom friend? And then she thinks, like, can I actually say the word bosom? But, yeah. And I remember reading Pippi Longstocking when I was little. So I read that to Lucy. That book is fucked up. Okay. Pippi is 9 years old, right? And her mother's dead. And her father is the sea captain who's out to sea. And she's living alone in Villa Villacoola with a monkey. That's not okay. Is it? But Pippi Longstocking is a good book, too. There's a new illustrated version. The woman who does the Charlie and Lola books illustrated Pippi Longstocking. For those of you who have 4- and 5-year-olds, you know what I'm talking about. It's really a nice – I've given it as a gift to lots of people. Anybody in the pink? Yes.
Well, as someone with my PhD, I have to tell you that being a book writer is probably certainly more lucrative and that you've definitely made a good choice.
Well, I don't know if I could have gotten into a PhD program, so I'm not sure how much of a, you know, how much agency was involved in my career path here. I don't know how it would have gone, you know, at my orals.
My question for you is, as a professional, I'll skip over that.
Sorry, go ahead.
As a professional working mom, mm-hmm. what helps you get through the toughest days? What do you tell yourself?
Oh, God. Well, I have a lot of help. Like, that is the total bottom line. I have a lot of help. I have a babysitter who comes every day from 11 to 7, and I have somebody who cleans, and I have an assistant. So I've basically, like, I've fixed my life so that what I do is I care for my children and I write. And I don't do laundry and I don't, like, take the car in to be inspected. Like, I have people to do that and I work. And I think that's the only way. Like, I think, like many moms, I had a fantasy of, like, oh, they'll nap and I'll write. It's like the fantasy of the Land's End swimsuit, you know, that it's not taking 10 pounds off and they're not napping. You know, so, like, you just have to get some help. And I tell everybody this, like, do not think that you are going to be, like, the superwoman and the one exception to the rule. Like, if you want to, I really believe, like, if you want to get anything done, you've got to get some help. And whether it's, like, working out some kind of babysitting exchange or, like, getting a relative or a grandparent or a husband or whoever to just, like, help. But, you know, I neglect the housework. That's another secret. You can, you know, but I really, you know, I'm so lucky because I have a lot of help and a lot of support, and there's, like, this sort of, you know, there's always people in the house, which is good, you know. So, you know, and I think, like, every working mom, I'm kind of conflicted. Like, are my daughters always going to remember me leaving? You know, is that going to be their memory of me sort of packing up my laptop and being like, you know, bye, mommy's got to work? But I honestly, like, I have such respect for full-time stay-at-home moms, because I couldn't do it. I just do not have the patience when they're that tiny. Because, like, pretending they're drunk will get me through, like, 15, 20 minutes. But, you know, and that's only if they walk into a screen door. So, you know, I was thinking about John and Kate plus 8, as I often do. Right. Did you all see who he's dating, the 22-year-old? Okay, she looks like a licked ashtray. I mean, not to, like, generalize from photographs, but she's a skank whore. And, you know, I only saw the show once. Like, of course, like, everybody else, every other jerk in America, I only tuned in after the whole, like, divorce thing. And I tuned in, like, and so, like, John is sitting on the couch. He's like, I don't know why the paparazzi follow me. I'm like, I know, it's because you're on TV. Yeah, uh-huh. But, you know, I was thinking, like, if that were me, it would be, like, a very short TV show consisting of the one episode where I threw myself off the Ben Franklin Bridge. You know, I just can't do it. So I have people who can. So there you have it. Neglect. My secret is neglect. And Spanx. How are we doing? What time is it? What's on TV tonight? What's going on? 8:30. What's happening here? You guys all want your book signed too, don't you? Yeah. It's going to be a long night. Yes. You. What? Where's my free shit? Where's the gifting suite? I know they have them, and nobody invites me. Go ahead. I'm sorry. What? What? Well, okay, here's the thing. Like, those of you who have the book, like, there's this lovely author photo. I don't ever look that good. Nobody recognizes me because, like, that's with, like, the blowout and the makeup and the lighting and retouching. So, like, it very, very, very rarely happens that somebody will be like, aren't you? And sometimes I deny it. And, but no, I keep waiting for, like, to be showered with free chicken wings from the Jerk Hut or something. And, like, honestly, nothing. Like, I can't even get a free bikini wax, you know? It's like, I would tell my salon, it's like, it's so funny. Like I wrote, there's this magazine called The Girlfriend's Getaway Guide, and I wrote about Philadelphia, and they're like, just like, tell us about your favorite places. So I did. And I'm just like, you know, like I like Cafe Estelle and I like Head House Books, and I get my hair and waxing needs taken care of at Salon Thalia. So like the last time I'm in there, I'm like, you know, hey, like, are you guys gonna, and the poor girl who like does my bikini line, she's like, no, too much work. So, like, I think that probably if you want to be a celebrity who is, like, celebrated as a celebrity, like, this is the wrong place to live, you know? Unless you're John Belaris. I followed him through the Reading Terminal once. He's not that tall. Yeah, but no, it's like, I mean, I'm just like, I'm like pushing the stroller. Like I'm at Super Fresh half the time. It's like, it's not real glam, you know, like John and Kate, like they're celebs. Do you know, I read her hair is called the reverse mullet. It's long in front and short in back. Yeah. And the girl he's dating is the plastic surgeon's daughter who did her free tummy tuck. Yes. Yes. People.com says so. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I know you've talked about your husband during the night, and he sounds like he's a great sport about it.
Yeah, he's going to beat me later, just you wait. He's going to go all Ike Turner on me. Just my name! Tina Turner! Well, we met when I had written Good in Bed but Not Sold It. So I remember giving him the manuscript, and I'm like, you know, like no one really had ever read it. And I was just like, he would call and be like, oh, this is really great. It's funny. I'm laughing. And I would always say, what page are you on? Because I wanted to figure out what page he got to when he stopped calling, you know, so I could like pinpoint it. But, no, it's sort of, you know, he was there sort of at the very beginning. And I don't know if it's changed things much, you know, like I was always off writing and he was always off lawyering and, you know, what do you think? You're not saying anything. You're not talking. You're going to take me to that recording studio I made you build in the basement and beat me, aren't you? And I don't have any Angela Bassett arms either. I can't defend myself good. Thank you guys so much. Oh, no, don't worry.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.